From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Poet W.S. Merwin says he spends his days making language describe the unsayable. On this edition of Fresh Air, W.S. Merwin reads from his latest collection. Also, we continue our conversation with singer Darlene Love. In the early 60s, Love sang lead on many of the girl group hits produced by Phil Spector, including He's a Rebel and He's Sure the Boy I Love. In part two of our conversation, Darlene Love talks about life after Spector and about her new solo album. And we have reviews of Bill Moyer's new interview series on public television and of a new jazz reissue featuring the music of Sidney Bechet. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Stephen Spender once wrote this about my guest poet W.S. Merwin. He wrote, "It is as though things write their own poems through Merwin. At their best, they are poems of total attention, and as such, they protest against our world of total distraction." Merwin has been honored with the Pulitzer Prize for his poetry, and he won an award from PEN, the International Writers Organization, for his translations. W.S. Merwin grew up in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip-mined. He's written many poems about the beauty of the natural world and the consequences of man's desecration of it. He now lives with his wife in Hawaii. Merwin has a new book of poems titled The Rain in the Trees. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him to read a poem, but this one's not about nature. It's about love and memory and having entered the world before the one you love.
Being early. When you were born, I was a small child in a city, and even if somebody had brought me news of you, I would not have believed them. Already I had seen an ape chained in the sun with a bucket of water. I had heard bells calling from wooden towers, stone towers, brick towers. I had seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy and a shadow shining on green water where tall birds were standing. And I knew the notes of streetcars and the smells of three rivers and could have told you about all of them if I had known you were there.
I think that's really a beautiful poem. And I was wondering what got you thinking about being born before your love was.
Well, no, it was the other way around. I mean, of course.
You being born before she was, yes.
Yes, because she's a bit younger, a few years younger than I am.
Yeah.
My wife. She's not very many years younger than I am, but enough for me to think about that. There were several years when she wasn't around.
There's a really striking image in the poem. You say that you'd seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy. And it's amazing how certain images just stay with you. I mean, do you remember when you actually saw that?
Oh,
when
I
you
do.
Were young?
Yes, I can remember. I must have been about 2 years old, and I was playing with some older girls. I mean, I thought of them as thoroughly grown up. They must have been all of 7 or 8, and I was 2. And one of them got hurt one day. And you know, when there are tiny children around, they always try to hush it up and not let you know what happened.
Right.
And I was very curious. And they lived upstairs, and I remember the silence and after the crying stopped, and then the two girls coming downstairs. I was made to wait down at the bottom of the stairs, one of those old houses down in Florida that had wooden steps coming down the back, you know. And I was supposed to wait down at the bottom. And I waited down there because I wanted to find out what happened. They came down, and there was this bandage with the blood coming through. And they both had new pieces of toffee candy that they were eating to make them feel better. I didn't get any.
Was that a very frightening image to you?
Well, it was curious, you know. There's a sort of Buddhist image of what one's existence in life is, that pleasure and pain are always mixed, and they talk about, you know, honey on a razor. It's that funny mixture. It's both exciting and frightening and something that one's both drawn to and repelled by, you know.
Yeah. Well, one last thing about this poem, Being Early, which you just read, it ends with, "I could have told you about all of them, all of these images, if I had known you were there." And, I mean, that's really like the writer's desire, isn't it, to tell?
Yes.
I mean, to
yes,
tell
it
people
is.
About things. Mm. And I wonder if you can explain your need or your desire to tell, to write, to describe.
If I could explain it, you know, it might go away. It's there all the time. And yet, you know, one, I don't think anybody ever knows exactly who they wanted. Some poems you know that you want to go to one specific person. And sometimes there's a poem in which there's someone, an image over one's shoulder, you know, that you're writing for. But there's always, I think you're always writing for everybody, don't you think? You know, everybody's experience, which they share with you and you share with them, and the experience behind a poem like that is not going to be anybody else's, and yet if it works, they're going to recognize something in their own lives that is the same.
Well, one of the things that interests me about your desire to tell, your desire to describe, is that you come from what you describe as a reticent family, a family of people who really didn't talk very much at all.
Yes, that's true. But that didn't make any difference. I can remember when I was very young listening to music, and I don't even think it was very, very interesting or very good music, but I was trying to explain what was wonderful about the music, and there was no way, I mean, nobody, there was no way of getting through to anybody. And of course, this is always there. I think there are always two sides to this thing. Finally, it's impossible to say what any experience is like to anybody else. And yet the miraculous thing about literature is that it does say so much it does allow one to, you know, this much misused word now, share. It does allow one to share experience with other people. Literally share it, the way you share a piece of bread or something like that, you know, when one person has one part of it and the other person has another part of it. And you recognize something that you have in common. And this is, you know, this is one of the really hopeful things about being alive, that one can do that. Can you imagine not being able to do it at all, the terrible isolation?
Sure.
Some people suffer that.
You once described poetry as using language as a vehicle for the unsayable.
That's it. It is unsayable. And one makes these kind of incursions on the unsayable, but of course the unsayable is infinite. There's no way, finally, of saying it. But we do say the most extraordinarily intimate and true things sometimes, and it's always amazing that we can do it. When you think that language is something that no one of us has made, it's something that we inherit and pick up as we go along, and it's and the word for the color red is the word for all of the colors red, and yet when we use it, we're talking about something very specific, and sometimes people can hear it and see something very specific out of their own lives.
You studied poetry with John Berryman at Princeton.
I did.
And you have a poem that I very much like that you wrote about advice that he gave you about poetry. And I'd really like it if you read that poem for us. And this is, my guess is W.S. Merwin, who has a new volume of poems called The Rain in the Trees. But this is an earlier poem that I'm asking you to read now.
It's out of the book that came before The Rain in the Trees, which is Opening the Hand. And it's now in the selected poems, too. And the poem is called Berryman. I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second World War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time, he suggested, changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out a thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse, get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it, literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in tides of his own through which he sailed, chin sideways and head tilted like a tacking sloop. He was far older than the dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he had affected in England. As for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and the bones of his long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmuted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't. You can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Gosh, I like that. At the end, you know, of the poem there, where he gives you that advice that if you have to be sure that your poems are good, don't write. I mean, was that really plaguing you a lot? How do you know if your poems are good?
Oh, no, it was a kind of a great relief. It made me feel that, you know, you couldn't kind of footsie around with it. You know, if you were going to write for the wrong reasons, and I think this is wonderful advice for anybody starting out, you know, if you're going to write for the wrong reasons, you'll reap the results of writing for the wrong reasons. If it's just an ego gratification, or if it's just for money and status and those things, well, you may get those things, but they're never going to be very satisfying.
But, you know, I think a lot of artists are really fueled by self-confidence, that they really believe in their stuff so much. They really believe that it's good.
That's great.
And it's that self-confidence that, you know, enables them to survive different, hard economic times or, you know, other insecurities.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it should never be forgotten. I mean, I see young writers who are very concerned about how big an advance they can get for their first book and the status that it's going to lead them to. And, you know, I understand that, and everything in the society pushes them that way. But I think it's very important to realize that almost anybody that we really admire as we grow up, and we're thinking of Van Gogh or Rambo or you know, Beethoven or anybody of the really great figures, there were periods in their lives, in most cases, in which they really had no money, and which the only thing that kept them going was this passion for what they wanted to do. It was Lowell says in Day by Day, in writing about Berryman, he said, we prayed to be obsessed with writing, and we are, you know. It's a sort of, it goes beyond neurosis. That Otto, the psychologist, said that the difference between a neurotic and an artist is that the artist does something with his neurosis.
I like that. You know, I have to tell you, a friend of mine was given the task a long time ago of meeting you on a college campus and taking you to the place where you were to do your reading. And he asked the teacher that was bringing you in, how will I recognize Merwin? And the teacher said, you'll recognize him. He looks like a poet. I wonder how you react to that.
There's no way to react to it because, if people think that, that's what they think. I don't know what a poet looks like. I'm glad if people think so.
Did you have an image in your own mind when you were coming of age and deciding to be a poet of what a poet's life was, what a poet looks like, what it means to be a poet, that kind of stuff?
I did. I thought that there were certain things you did not do. I thought that it was very important to be independent. And to me, it was very important to maintain certain links with things that meant a great deal to me. One of them was the natural world, and I've always felt that. I mean, I think that I've always felt that I had one foot in the city and one foot in a very unurban place, and I still feel that way. The city for me is history. It's the contact with history. But history is not everything. I mean, history comes out of something which is much larger, and we're trying to destroy it. Well, we aren't going to succeed. We're going to make a terrible mess of things around us, but the natural world will survive us, I think.
Is this why you're living in Hawaii now, to be
one of the
more
reasons,
around nature?
I love it there. I think it's important for people to try to live in a way they want to live. And, of course, not everybody can do it. I mean, many people really are caught in circumstances that they really feel they can't control. But a young poet that I met recently talked about in a lecture about having asked people in a lecture that she'd given a few months before. She'd asked a lot of people to put all their books aside and just put a piece of paper on the desk and draw for the next 5 minutes the ideal home. I mean, the ideal place where they would like to live. And that they, you know, they could take it out of any part of their lives, out of their past, out of their childhoods, out of the present or anything. And then she said, all right, now turn the page, paper over, and draw the place where you're living now. And think about the difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, why are you not living where you want to be living? Is it really that you've made so many compromises which may be why you're unhappy with your lives, as many people are?
Well, there's a real short poem I'd like to ask you to read called Witness.
Witness. There are many. The new book is called The Rain in the Trees, and this is one of the trees poems. Witness. I want to tell what the forests were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. there's something behind that poem. My feeling that as the kind of imperialism that's built into our situation right now. I mean, I hear that 75% of the world's letters now are being written in English. And what does that mean for the gene pool of language, you know? That as that happens, and our point of view does not broaden, in fact, it narrows. And we think that other cultures really are uninteresting. I mean, that oral cultures somehow are clumsy attempts to really be like us. I mean, that's what they're all trying to do and failing. Along with that goes a growing indifference to the disappearance of other kinds of cultures, other ways of being human, other ways of being in the world. And I think that indifference is part of the destruction of the natural world that's going on around us. I mean, the most appalling example of it now is the continuing destruction of the rainforests all through the tropics of the planet, and the effects of that. I mean, whether people in the cities care about trees or anything like that, we do care about breathing, you know, and our oxygen comes from there.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and hear some more of your poems, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is poet W.S. Merwin, and he has a new collection of poems called The Rain in the Trees, and the poem he just read is from that collection. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Poet W.S. Merwin is my guest. You're just talking about the destruction of the forest. Now, you grew up, in part, in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip mined. Has seeing that happen to places where your family lived affected you a lot?
I think that was seeing the first strip mine was a kind of traumatic experience that in some ways I never got over. I just stood there, I remember, as a child of about 10, and tears ran down my face. I couldn't believe that anyone would do a thing like that. And I couldn't believe that there was anything worth doing anything like that for. And this was an area that I had known a few months before as a mountainside. It wasn't primitive, primeval forest, but it was beautiful second growth forest. And suddenly here was this great gouge in the earth about 100 feet deep and about 300 feet wide with a big steam shovel down the bottom of it, and a lot of water with sulfur in it and new erosion lines down the sides of the banks, and that was all that was there. And I, you know, it was a shock that I can remember wandering around the rest of that afternoon in a kind of daze, couldn't believe this. And found out what it was, and in a way, I've never come to terms with it. I think that our ability to do that to the world that we've been given, in a way, is something that we're doing to ourselves, and it's something we're doing to our lives.
I want to ask you something else about your family. You talked before about how your family wasn't a very verbal family. You've described yourself as growing up in a kind of bookless home. If that was so, how did you get interested in reading and in writing?
My mother read to me, and she read very well, and she cared about reading. My father was a minister, he's a Presbyterian minister, and you'd have thought he read, but he didn't read very much. But I did care about the books that were read to me, and there was one book in particular about Indians that was a book for children to learn to read from, and I taught myself to read out of that book because I wanted to find out about these pictures of these about who these people were in the pictures, you know, and it was a book that began, you know, a man, an Indian man, and so forth. And by the time I got through the book, I learned a tiny bit about Indians and a tiny bit about reading, and was able to go on from there. But it's occurred to me that it's rather strange to have learned to read to find out about an oral people and the way they lived.
An interesting contradiction. Since your parents weren't much, didn't read much, when you started to write, Did you miss the kind of parental approval and appreciation that you might have liked to have?
Well,
like, God, that's a great poem, William.
Oh, no, I never got that. But I tried to write hymns first, you see. They had the first poems that I knew about were the hymns down in the church, and I was kind of fascinated by those. And I tried to write some more hymns, and I thought my father should at least do me the courtesy of using them in the service.
Which he didn't.
He didn't, no.
After college, you went abroad and tutored in several different countries. Did you start to reinvent your life when you were very far away from your home? Embroider little things, change things around?
Well, I think it began to develop a slightly rosy glow. I got very homesick. I was living on very little money. I worked for the BBC for a number of years.
Oh, doing translations for them?
Doing translations for the third program, in the great days of the third program. And so I could live on very little money in London. And I knew that if I came back, I'd have to get a respectable job and probably teach college or something like that. I didn't want to do that because I saw many of my contemporaries getting caught in a kind of fixed career in which they began to feel that they couldn't live outside it. And I felt very clear that I could live outside it and that I wanted to be footloose and independent, and that seemed to be very important. So I stayed away for 7 years, but I was getting very homesick at the same time.
Many of your poems are about memory and memories. Do you trust yours? And does that matter?
Well, what does that mean? You know, of course, one does not remember exactly what's there, but one doesn't see exactly what's there. One sees what one sees, and one remembers what one remembers, and it is a kind of reality. Nobody sees what's there. You know, if we talk about what we're looking at, we describe two different things, you know. And if we, the farther we get away from it, the more it changes. But what's changing is us. And so, you know, the memory, as long as one doesn't pretend that it's historic, historically accurate, it's accurate in a different way, and which is somewhere between historic accuracy and the imagination itself. And one doesn't really, one can control that, but only up to a point.
There's a poem about a memory I'd like for you to read. It's called Waking to the Rain.
Again, the book is called The Rain in the Trees, and there are many trees and much rain. I'm very fond of both of them. Waking to the Rain. The night of my birthday, I woke from a dream of harmony, suddenly hearing an old man, not my father, I said, but it was my father, gasping my name as he fell on the stone steps outside, just under the window in the rain. I do not know how many times he may have called before I woke. I was lying in my parents' room in the empty house, both of them dead that year, and the rain was falling all around me, the only sound.
Can I ask what did happen that night when
just,
you woke?
And just exactly that.
Was it really a man, or were you dreaming?
Oh, I think it was in that state that you are between dreaming and waking. I think I dreamed it, but I don't know. I mean, after all, I was sleeping in my parents' bedroom, and anything could have happened. They had died not very long before that.
Has that happened to you a lot, where you come out of a dream and you think you hear something and you don't know if you did or not?
Oh, not a lot, but fairly often.
Yeah, it's a very interesting state.
Yes.
That's one of the things that interests me in this poem.
Very, very important state. I think you're seeing something. You're seeing something that you don't see in any other state. Dante talks about it, you know, in the Divine Comedy. If you go through it, you find that he makes various transitions by means of various dreams. And there's one place where he talks very, very, very brilliantly, and as always, and very concisely about that state of mind just before one is awake and when one is really asleep, but also partly awake. Another wonderful book on the subject, on that subject, is James Hillman's The Dream in the Underworld, which was published a year or two ago.
No, you were saying a little earlier that when you were younger and went to Europe after college, you really wanted to learn to be independent and not have to have that 9-to-5 kind of job. You've managed to stay alive as a poet, support yourself. How have you supported yourself over the years? You've not taught, right?
Well, I've taught a little bit. I've taught at Cooper Union.
But you haven't been a full-time professor.
No?
Haven't been associated for many years with the university, which is the way many poets have supported themselves.
Well, I did manage to earn a certain amount of money for a number of years by translating. And I think it's important not to have very high standards of how, not to have a very high standard of living. I mean, to be able to live, I mean, it never occurred to me that I was going to make a lot of money, and I haven't. And but it didn't matter. It's never mattered very much, because the things that I did care about, I cared about so much more than that. So I just resigned myself to the fact that it wasn't going to happen. And as long as I could be independent and could you know, pay the bills, and that was all right. And I've had a number of fellowships and grants. If you average them out over the years, they don't amount to very much, but they've come along at intervals that when it was very helpful, you know. That's really how it's been, sort of hand to mouth. But I've been extremely lucky. On the other hand, I think that if you start getting yourself into a very secure but rather rigid situation too early in your life, there may be strokes of luck that come your way that you can't use, you know. My first trip to Europe as a tutor was there purely because I didn't have any particular thing that I had to do, and when the chance to do this one came along, I said, fine, I can take it, you know. And it led to other positions like that.
I would like to ask you to read one final poem before we have to conclude. Now, since I've chosen all of the poems so far, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to to choose one you especially would like to read.
Well, what about the first poem in The Rain in the Trees, which is called Late Spring? Coming into the high room again after years, after oceans and shadows of hills and the sounds of lies, after losses and feet on stairs, after looking and mistakes and forgetting, turning there thinking to find no one except those I knew, finally I saw you sitting in white, already waiting. You of whom I had heard with my own ears since the beginning, for whom more than once I had opened the door, believing you were not far.
When did you write that? And what were the circumstances behind the writing of it?
I wrote it in New York in the summer of 1982 sometime. The circumstances. Oh, you mean, well, I was with my wife and I was thinking about meeting her.
Mm-hmm. You know, in so many of your poems, you seem so surprised to have had such a wonderful relationship with one woman. I just seem perpetually surprised in your poems about that.
Oh, I think it's a very surprising thing to be alive, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
And that's the most wonderful thing that can happen, is to have that kind of relation with somebody. I mean, that's the most. So it's the most surprising thing of all.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for reading some of your poems and for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
W.S. Merwin's latest book of poems is titled The Rain in the Trees. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with General Chuck Yeager, the first man to fly faster than the speed of sound. Yeager has written a new autobiography titled Press On, Further Adventures in the Good Life. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the early 1960s, Darlene Love could have been described as an anonymous star. She sang lead on He's a Rebel, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, and other girl group hits produced by Phil Spector, but her work wasn't always credited. Coming up as we continue our discussion, Darlene Love talks about life after Spector, her current solo career, and her new solo album. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the legendary Sidney Bechet, a new reissue featuring the music of the great New Orleans clarinetist and soprano saxophonist. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Bill Moyer's World of Ideas. It's Moyer's new series of nightly, in-depth interviews on public television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. There were new resignations from the George Bush campaign today amid allegations of anti-Semitism, NPR's Jim Angle reports.
Late today, five more members of an ethnic coalition resigned amidst allegations they had ties to pro-Nazi groups. The five said they were removing themselves from the controversy, though they insisted they had been attacked unfairly by George Bush's political opponents. The campaign itself said it conducted a review of all of the allegations and was unable to substantiate any of them. A statement from the five blamed the attacks on John Sasso, the co-chairman of the Dukakis campaign. Bush campaign spokesman Alix Gwynn said these appear to be little more than politically motivated attacks, but they've done the right thing by removing themselves. Another member of the 88-person group resigned last week, and a key official at the Republican National Committee, Red Malik, resigned yesterday after it was learned he identified the Jewish members of the Bureau of Labor Statistics under orders from President Nixon in 1971. I'm Jim Angle with the Bush campaign in Alton, Illinois.
Michael Dukakis today accused George Bush of bungling his two main assignments in the Reagan administration. Dukakis said Bush has lost ground in the battles against drugs and terrorism. He told 200 supporters at a Union Hall in Philadelphia that Bush was disastrously, completely, and unforgivably wrong for not warning President Reagan against selling arms to Iran in an attempt to free hostages in Lebanon. Bush, meanwhile, challenged Dukakis to state his view on the U.S. attack against Libya and the invasion of Grenada. The government today recommended that every home in the country be tested for deadly radon gas. The Environmental Protection Agency this afternoon released the results of a report that suggests the radon risk is greater than previously estimated. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has details.
Every year, the EPA estimates as many as 20,000 lung cancer deaths are caused by radon, a radioactive gas produced when uranium deposits decay underground. In a survey of seven states this year, the EPA found that one in three homes had higher than acceptable levels of radon. The survey also found an area of high radon concentration that extends from Minnesota into North Dakota. EPA Administrator Lee Thomas says when the seven states surveyed this year are added to the 10 surveyed last year, a national problem emerges.
We can now predict that in those states that we've surveyed, that over 3 million homes would have elevated levels of more than 4 picocuries per liter.
EPA suggests that virtually every house and apartment be tested using a simple kit available from hardware stores. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Lebanese authorities say the kidnappers of West German Rudolf Cortes released him in southern Beirut today after almost 2 years of captivity. A Lebanese government spokesman said the 53-year-old businessman looked fine and in good shape. The kidnappers reportedly left Cortes near the Kuwaiti embassy in southern Beirut. The State Department today said a U.S. citizen kidnapped yesterday in Lebanon escaped from his captors and returned to the U.S. embassy in Syria. The American was identified as Kenneth Wells, an employee of Litton Industries in Saudi Arabia. Officials say Wells was seized by armed gunmen as he was leaving his wedding reception in Beirut with his Lebanese bride. She was briefly detained and released. Several hours later, the 25-year-old Wells overpowered his kidnappers, escaping to a Syrian checkpoint. Wells was later turned over to a U.S. embassy official in Damascus. He is said to hold a black belt in karate. Stocks on Wall Street moved marginally higher today in slow trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 3 points to close at 2072.19. Declines led advances 7-5 on volume of 115 million shares. Traders attributed today's slow performance to the Jewish holiday. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new reissue featuring clarinetist and soprano saxophonist Sidney Bechet. He's considered the first great jazz saxophonist and the only early jazz musician to rival Louis Armstrong as a soloist. Still, Kevin says, Bechet had to fight to make himself heard.
There have been many bullheaded pioneers in jazz, but few as stubborn as Sidney Bechet, some of whose recordings from the 30s and early 40s are on a new reissue, the legendary Sidney Bechet on RCA Bluebird. The clarinetist grew up in New Orleans when the music was young and remembered jazz before musicians' habits of convenience solidified into law. When the rules for ensemble playing did take shape, he found himself a clarinet player in a world where trumpet was king. In New Orleans-style jazz, the trumpet takes the lead while the clarinet weaves a supporting line around it. But Bechet declined to accept his second-class status. When he asserted himself, he came in for the same criticisms feminists heard 40 years later, that he didn't know his place or wanted to be something that he wasn't. They even said his voice was too shrill. Sidney Bechet became empowered in the early 1920s when he shifted his focus from the clarinet to the soprano saxophone, which plays in the same range but is a lot louder. With an instrument made of brass, he could compete with trumpeters on their own terms. Listen to Bechet and trumpeter Tommy Ladner knock heads jockeying for the lead on I Found a New Baby from 1932. In challenging the established hierarchy of instruments, Bechet paved the way for the liberation of subservient bassists and drummers decades later. By adapting a fluid clarinet conception to the huff-and-puff sax in the early 20s, Bechet influenced literally every jazz saxophonist to come, including all the ones from Charlie Parker to Steve Lacy, who sought escape from the old man's wide vibrato. Duke Ellington, who loved a distinctive instrumental voice, was a great admirer of Bechet. According to John Chilton, in his fine biography, Sidney Bechet, The Wizard of Jazz, published a few months ago, Bechet's 1941 version of Ellington's The Mooch was the composer's favorite. The Bechet Sextet's skeletal version of Duke Sound anticipates by more than a decade Charles Mingus's miniaturized Ellington. With Bechet on The Mooch are trumpeter Henry Goodwin and trombonist Vic Dickinson. Bechet scorned the idea that he was a mere Dixieland musician and played a wide variety of material. The anti-lynching song Strange Fruit was made famous by Billie Holiday. But when Bechet recorded it in 1941, he gave it the raw blues power of Bessie Smith and a touch of Enrico Caruso. Thank you. I'm glad RCA is dipping into its Bechet stockpile again. This new reissue isn't the whole meal. The double album set of his Bluebird sides RCA released in the 70s was more generous. But this is a good first helping. Still, if the big record companies didn't let classics like this go out of print, they wouldn't have to reissue them every 10 years, would they? Do they do this to Toscanini, too?
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the reissue The Legendary Sidney Bechet on the RCA Bluebird record label. This is Fresh Air. Darlene Love was the lead singer on some of the great girl group hits of the early 60s, produced by Phil Spector. Songs like He's a Rebel, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, and He's Sure the Boy I Love. Last time on Fresh Air, Love told us about how Spector recorded her and her group The Blossoms under several names, The Crystals, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans, and Darlene Love. While recording with Spector, The Blossoms also had a regular spot on the TV show Shindig. After Darlene Love split with Spector, she continued to do backup work with the Blossoms on the road and in the studio. It wasn't until 1981 that Darlene Love ventured out on her own and performed solo. That comeback was captured on a live album on Rhino Records. Love has a new album called Paint Another Picture, and it's her first studio-produced solo record. When Love first went solo, the fans wanted to hear the old songs like He's a Rebel. Since you didn't really tour and perform much when you were recording in the early 60s, did you still feel the sense of the songs belonging to you like performers feel when they sing them over and over and over again after they've become hits?
I didn't really feel like that until much later when I decided to have a solo career about 4 or 5 years ago, that the songs really belonged to me. And they were fresh also because I had never worked them.
Sure, you know, a lot of singers, I'm sure, get to hate their own songs.
I'm sure.
And feel imprisoned by their own repertoire.
Right.
How did you split with Phil Spector?
It was during the time we were doing Shindig, 1964, 65. Phil had a little thing about himself that he didn't like to share his artists with anybody else. Doing Shindig gave us a whole nother perspective away from Phil Spector. And eventually, he just let us go rather than compete with the television show. So we kind of left, not really on bad terms, but not on good terms either. It was just, we just stopped talking, stopped dealing. I signed a contract, a recording contract, in 1966 with Gamble and Huff in Philadelphia to start recording with them. And after being in Philadelphia for 2 or 3 days, one of the guys called me and told me to come into the office, and they told me they had just gave my contract to Phil Spector after all those years. And there I was, thought I was free of Phil Spector, and there I was back with him again. And I found out later that their lawyers and Phil Spector's lawyer was the same lawyer. And that's how he got me back again.
Did you actually record with him again?
One time. And it was during... I got along with Phil fine the first, from 62 to 65. But when I got back with him around 66, 67, he had changed. He had become, I guess, the big, powerful machine in this business that I didn't really relate to. And when I went into the recording studio with him, it was all about a game, it seemed like, anyway. It was a song we recorded called Lord, If You're a Woman, that I'd never liked the song, but I recorded it anyway. And me and Phil got into a big fight while I was recording it. We had spent probably a couple of hours on the song recording, so he had enough takes on it. And he started playing games, like people were coming into the studio, and he would say, I'm gonna make her sing it again. They would play with the lights, you know, just teeny boppers. Things, you know, stuff that make you very mad, irritable. So while this was going on, I just said, excuse me, is anybody listening to me? And I said, I'm leaving. Phil, it's been nice. And I walked out of the studio and never came back. But Phil put that record out exactly the way it was.
Did you like it?
No. I was very upset about that. Because it wasn't a very good vocal, I didn't think.
Lord, if you're a woman, listen to your sister. Lord, if you're a woman, I know you'll understand.
Over the past few years, you've started singing solo again. In 1981, you did a nightclub act at Bill Medley's nightclub. Just a couple of years ago, you performed in Leader of the Pack, which was a review of songs written by Ellie Greenwich. You've performed in clubs with Paul Schaefer accompanying you. Were you surprised when you found out that you had fans who knew who you were, who knew who Darlene Love was?
I wasn't surprised. I was shocked. I just didn't. When you stay out of touch, you know, with the public, you don't really know. You don't even realize. I had no idea that the people still really love these songs until I decided to start this solo career again. Even today, I can't even get on the stage without singing like songs like Do Run Run. And even the song that was on the Christmas album, Christmas Baby Please Come Home, the audience just will not let me off the stage without singing a lot of those songs because they really do love them.
You have a new record, and on it you do a lot of new songs. You do one standard, When You Walk Through a Storm, and you do one song, but only one song, associated with your past, He Sure the Boy I Love, which you sing, He Sure the Man I Love. Tell me what went into your decision to do that one song.
Well, that came about because of my manager, Kenny Laguna. When I first got back with him and we were trying to decide what we were going to do, Kenny had this idea to do He's Sure the Boy I Love because he thought it was a great song, and he thought out of all the songs that I did with Phil Spector, that was one of the greatest songs that we did because of the lyrics. And he thought if we slowed it down and gave it a funkier beat, that would be a great record.
He doesn't look like a movie star. He doesn't drive a Cadillac car. He's sure.
You said that Phil Spector controlled a little the way you sang, that he wanted to tone down your singing. Do you think that you sing differently on this album than listeners will remember from your earlier records?
I think so. They're going to hear more of, I think, the soulfulness that I have down inside of me on this album more than they did on the earlier things. But I think today it's just a more, an adult, you know, matured sound, the way I feel about those songs today, because my producers that produced this record let me sing these songs the way I sing them in person. And that's what I think is the difference.
You've, as far as I know, stayed off of the oldies circuit for the past few years. And there's been a lot of performers from the early 60s on the oldies circuit. Now, can we expect to see you on that, or are you going to continue to stay off it?
No. I'm going to continue to stay off it because I think it brands you. It keeps you with a certain group of people. Also, the oldie shows doesn't really give you a chance to let the people know who you are. You go out on the stage, you sing your two hits or your three hits or whatever. You know, it doesn't really, I'm really just getting started after the third or fourth song. I like for my audience to get to know who I am, and you can't do that when you do those shows.
And you want to sing new material, too?
Right.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Darlene Love's new album, Paint Another Picture, is on Columbia Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's in store for us on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Any big campaign stories for us?
We do have campaign stories tonight. We have a number of them. The Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis is now focusing on foreign policy today in Philadelphia. Dukakis said he would base his foreign policy on a strong economy as well as a strong military defense. And meanwhile, the next state over, George Bush campaigning in New Jersey, challenged the Democratic candidate to get specific. And before a crowd of cheering Cuban Americans, he invoked the Reagan record on foreign policy.
Who's your pick of the week?
Our pick of the week this week is Nigeria's foremost steel pedal guitar player, a man by the name of Demola Adepoju.
And you'll see what he's been listening to.
Right.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, journalist Bill Moyers joins the ranks of Geraldo Rivera, Oprah Winfrey, and Sally Jesse Raphael. This week, Bill Moyers becomes a talk show host. But television critic David Bianculli says Moyers is decidedly different.
These are strange times for TV talk shows. Morton Downey Jr. huffs and puffs his way through each show, calling most of his guests pablum pukers. Geraldo, Oprah, and Sally are outraged because they've allegedly been suckered by guests who have misrepresented their sexual habits in order to appear on TV. Personally, I find it more of an outrage that all three shows found it necessary to book the same two guests. If there aren't more than two people in America with a particular sexual problem, why do a show about it? TV talk shows, for the most part, are getting increasingly outrageous and decreasingly intelligent. The topics are narrow and the time allotted to each guest is short. People now go on talk shows and morning news programs to sell themselves, their ideas, or their art in 5 minutes or less. These aren't conversations, they're summaries. And the things they're summarizing are usually absurd or irrelevant. For the next 10 weeks, Bill Moyers is defiantly going against the flow. In his new PBS series, Bill Moyers' World of Ideas, he spends 30 minutes each weeknight talking and really listening to one guest. And there isn't a fake guest or a pablum puker in the bunch. Moyers, instead, is giving airtime to historians, philosophers, scientists, and artists whose voices are rarely, if ever, heard on Good Morning America. One of Moyers' guests this week is Jessica Tuckman Matthews of the World Resources Institute, who talks about the weather, but from an unusually informed viewpoint.
All around the world, we're seeing anomalous, strange weather this year. And it also appears now that pretty good evidence that 1988 will be the hottest year in recorded history. And the four warmest years before this were 1980, 81, 83, and 87.
So they're all bunching up right here.
And that's in 135 years of records. There's very little question about what's happening.
Matthews also talks about the relationship of the automobile industry to the environment. What she says is amazing. And so is the fact that Moyers gives her the time to make her point.
Our energy future is centers around the automobile, and our attachment, our just deep emotional attachment to cheap gasoline. And the reason that we have such poor performance in Detroit in terms of automobile efficiency is because we are running on cheap gasoline. It's an anachronism. And that's why when you look around the world, you see Renault with a 124 mile per gallon prototype automobile, and Toyota with a 98 mile per gallon five-passenger prototype, and Volvo with a 70 mile per gallon one, which they expect to upgrade to 90, and us with none in that category.
What Moyers is doing here is taking the format he used in Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth, an astoundingly good six-part conversation for TV, and condensing it into a nightly talk show, a show without a studio audience and without any sense of hysteria. It's a wonderful, welcome change from most TV talk shows, which seem more like Roman circuses. Which, by the way, are mentioned by another guest, filmmaker and former studio head David Putnam. He compares today's sensationalism in film and TV to the era of ancient Rome.
What might have been a woman raped by raped publicly by a centurion, a year later was a woman raped publicly by an ass. And 10 years later was 10 women raped publicly by 100 asses. I mean, the audience's desire for that goes way back, deep into history. Someone has to say, enough, because this is disaster. We are destroying ourselves.
Bill Moyers, in that respect, can be considered disaster relief. Moyers doesn't just deliver the goods. He delivers the greats.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time I speak with comic Carol Leifer. She's had her own HBO special, and she's appeared often on Late Night with David Letterman, but she knows she's never going to be the perfect woman of the 80s. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the career of singer and disc jockey Rufus Thomas, who brought elements of black vaudeville to the emerging rock scene. He's best remembered for dance songs like The Dog and The Funky Chicken. And book critic John Leonard reviews Picture This, the new novel by Joseph Heller. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KSMU in Springfield, Missouri. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.